My name is Evan White, and you're listening to the Stories on Stage Davis podcast. In this week's episode, we're presenting the second winning story in the Under the Gum Tree magazine and Stories on Stage Davis creative nonfiction contest. The Money Place is by Caroline Goodwin, who attended Stanford as a Wallace Stegner Fellow in Poetry in 1999, and from 2014 to 16, she served as the first Poet Laureate of San Mateo County. She is also the author of the poetry collections Custody of the Eyes and The Paper Tree. Reading The Money Place is actor Kat Miller, who is a member of the Actors' Equity Association and is returning for her fifth appearance at our series. Stay tuned after the reading to hear Caroline Goodwin on the inspiration behind her story. But first, here's Kat Miller reading the 2020 Under the Gum Tree and Stories on Stage Davis creative nonfiction winner, The Money Place.
The Money Place by Caroline Goodwin. It's late afternoon, August 10, 2016. I'm walking the trail around Lake Temescal in Oakland, and the biggest loss of my life is right around the corner. Of course, I don't know this yet. I just hear the sound of chewing, so I stop and look down into the reeds. It's a river otter. He swims a little ways, dives, resurfaces, and looks up at me, chomping loudly. And I can hardly believe it. The afternoon light, green and black in the swampy water, the animal so close I can see its teeth, the whoosh of traffic along Highway 24, the hair stands up on the back of my neck. Sitka, Alaska, my mother's hometown, is Tlingit country. In Tlingit mythology, the spirit of the shape-shifting Kushtaka is closely linked to the river otter, or the land otter if you prefer. When I was a child visiting my grandfather, he spoke to me about the Kushtaka. "Watch out," he'd say as we walked past the salmon berries and Devil's Club along the river. "This is the Kushtaka path." The Kushtaka would kidnap the kids who misbehaved and keep them in the forest forever. So whenever I spied the hollow hemlock behind the visitor center at the National Historical Park, it was the Kushtaka tree. The uprooted spruce with its hairy fingers in the air, another Kushtaka tree. The culvert at the end of Dog Creek, lair of the Kushtaka. And I was not a good girl. I smoked Marlboro Reds after gymnastics class with Julia Moore. I went home and breathed on my younger brother to show him what a grown-up I was. And I took a little pleasure in his fear. River otters are quite different from the comical sea otters, the ones that hold hands while floating on their backs, cracking shellfish with rocks on their chests for lunch, playfully weaving themselves in and out of kelp beds. River otters are smaller than sea otters, actually only a quarter of the size of their cousins. Their fur is not nearly as dense. Their tails are longer and more rounded. They lack the large, rear, flipper-like feet of sea otters and are agile on land, where sea otters are awkward and clumsy. The river otters forage in both water and on land, but prefer to eat on land. The sea otters sleep and eat in the water, totally different creatures. In her book, Shamans and Kushtakas, North Coast Tales of the Supernatural, Mary Gerardo Beck writes, Kushtakas were human beings who had been transformed by land otters into creatures similar to themselves, but who retained some human qualities. They kidnapped children, frightened women, and caused storms, avalanches, disease, and famine. Kushtakas had been given their dual role by Raven when he bestowed on land otters the gift of being able to live both on land and underwater, as well as powers of illusion and disguise. In addition, he gave them the special mission of saving those lost at sea or in the woods and transforming them into half-human, half-otter-like beings. The land otters fulfilled their mission so well that people suspected them of actively luring victims to their kingdom. Deathly afraid of the animals, humans did not hunt them for food or clothing. Children were taught to be aware of the land otter people, who would appear as their close relatives to invite them into boats or kidnap them in the woods. They were trained early to resist Kushtaka influence by developing a strong will and respecting and observing tribal customs. So at Lake Temescal in August 2016, with that river otter chewing and holding my gaze, I hold still and I breathe. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't afraid. I think of the one who ran across Sawmill Creek Road at midnight in 1989 when I was headed home after swing shift driving forklift at Alaska Pulp Corporation. A full moon hung just above the old-growth spruce hemlock forest, and a chill came over me, some kind of premonition. The next day, my friend Tom came off his moped near the historical park, hit his head on a rock, and lingered in a coma for several weeks before he died. It was the first sudden trauma of my life. My live-in boyfriend at the time sat me down in the kitchen with the news. We held Tom's service at the Coast Guard station on Alice Island, releasing balloons into the air and watching them float out over Sitka Sound toward Mount Verstovia. Tom was 21 years old. I was 25. I think about him now, about his tousled hair and long stride, and the yellow Volkswagen thing he drove around town with the top down, even in the rain. I look down at the critter and tell it, I'm a good person. I try my best on a daily basis to perform well as mother, daughter, sister, wife, teacher, friend. I follow the rules. Besides, everything has already happened to me. When my right leg was crushed in an accident at the pulp mill in 1990, I watched the EMT who was caring for me in the ambulance turn blue and die of a massive heart attack. During 1996 and 97, I survived daily bouts of trigeminal neuralgia, the most painful affliction known to man until it was resolved by gamma knife surgery. They fried just a tiny bit of the nerve at the base of my brain. In September 2001, I watched my four-month-old daughter, Josephine Neville, survive a liver transplant in which the liver was too large and the surgeons could not fully close her abdomen. The liver failed. She got another one, but extensive damage had already been done to her intestines. In November 2001, I hit and killed a pedestrian, a 45-year-old mother of three, with my Subaru Legacy on Highway 92 just east of Half Moon Bay, California. In April 2002, I held my dead one-year-old daughter Josephine Neville in my arms at Stanford Hospital. My husband Nick was at my side. She had made 17 trips to the operating room. Seriously. So if anyone has earned smooth sailing for the duration, I often think that it should be me. But of course, it doesn't work that way. The Kushtaka keeps chomping and glaring up from the reeds. I tell it to get lost, scram, leave me alone. It dives again. I watch the water for a while. A wren flits by and lands on a wet log. A couple of fishermen walk past on the trail, headed to the small dock with their buckets and gear. I think I hear something splashing further north along the shore, but I'm not going to follow it. I'm headed in the opposite direction anyway. The traffic whooshes. I offer a prayer of safety for my loved ones, finish my walk, and teach my evening class. But I am unsettled and hypervigilant. Driving home, I take it slow. I am relieved when I get there safely by 11, check on my two sleeping daughters, and snuggle up next to Nick. A Google search will yield such links as, river otters are thriving all over the Bay Area, and, after decades away, river otters make a triumphant return. You can also Google the Kushtaka and find the Wikipedia entry, right alongside the story of Charlie Sheen's trip to Sitka in search of the supernatural, and several YouTube videos about land otter man. When I tell Nick about my Lake Temescal sighting, he is thrilled. A true environmentalist, what he hears is the return of nature, Something that belongs here and was edged out is now finding a way to claim a space again. This must be good for everyone, right? But what about the Kushtaka? I say. Oh, and Sasquatch too, I suppose, he says. It's an affectionate form of teasing that's evolved between us over the years. When I was 11, I spied a Sasquatch rising up out off of a ditch in Chickaloon, 80 miles north of Anchorage. Nick likes to rib me about this. Of course, I'm being completely ridiculous. It was a bear or a moose in that ditch. But I say the Sasquatch is just very smart and lives by the axiom of the good camper. Leave no trace. And looking back on it now, there are times when I wonder if I could have changed things, or if I could have perhaps slowed down and been more in tune with the universe. On the bad days, I think I could have told Nick I would stay home for the fateful evening after all, that he didn't need to rush back to make dinner. On the good days, I understand that when a person's time is up, it's up, and there's not a lot you can do. But maybe that Lake Temescal River otter really was the Kushtaka. 10 days later, on Friday, August 26, 2016, Nick Goodwin, 59, my husband of 24 years, my greatest and only love, and the father of my daughters, hits a rut on Montara Mountain, goes over his handlebars and breaks his neck. Two hikers find him face down with his bike on his back. They try CPR, but it is too late. The feeling is one of falling, the ground suddenly soft under my feet, or of reaching out for a guardrail that is no longer there and reaching again. My entire body is a hollow space. The air becomes a kind of syrup. How will I move and breathe? The house fills up with flowers. My two daughters, 12 and 19, are so young and so beautiful, I can hardly bear to look at them. I weep on the couch. I sit on the back porch and talk on the phone. People bring meals. A neighbor sends a card that reports how calm and steely blue the evening was when Nick died. I visualize his spirit breaking free of the body, unfolding enormous and colorful wings. There is a little seed of comfort in the fact that it was quick and probably painless, an intense flash of light. Like many Americans, Nick and I would often joke about moving to Canada. After George W. Bush's re-election, we said, "That's it, we're going," as if Canada were just waiting with open arms. Our thing, however, was that we'd really go north. We loved the fact that there was a city called Yellowknife, which sounded brutal and familiar to us. Yellowknife. It became a kind of code. When the political situation looked really bad, we'd just say Yellowknife to one another and smile. It helped somehow, just knowing such a place existed. So when I started to put the days together after losing him, when I focus on my goal of walking through the first year, I decide that I will mark the 12-month anniversary of his death by actually visiting Yellowknife. This gives me a concrete goal, a distraction, and I need it. In my research, I discover that Yellowknife is the capital and the only city of the Northwest Territories. It has a population of nearly 20,000, and it sits on the north shore of the Great Slave Lake. The South Slavey name is Somba Cay, the money place. I could drive for 40 hours to get there, or I could fly to Calgary from SFO and take another plane straight north for 90 minutes from there. I see that it is also 250 miles south of the Arctic Circle, just about the same latitude as Fairbanks, so I will be in a landscape similar to the landscape of my childhood. I look at Airbnb, car rentals, airfare. I discover that there's a road in Yellowknife called Ragged Ass Road, where I can buy myself a pair of tie-dyed long johns. That seals the deal. I book my flight and rent an entire houseboat on a private lake. The propeller plane touches down at midnight on August 20, 2017. The Yellowknife Airport displays a stuffed polar bear chasing a stuffed seal through a hole in a fake iceberg. I'm right at home. The owner of the houseboat is out of town and has sent his best friend Ryan to meet me and escort me to the lake. We text and he finds me at baggage claim, a young man with long brown hair and a big smile. "Welcome to Yellowknife," he says, shaking my hand. "Thanks. Nice sculpture," I say, pointing to the polar bear and seal. "Yeah, perfect. We don't have either of those guys around here," he says, and we laugh. Outside, it's a little chilly and not yet completely dark. He jumps into his Jeep with his two big dogs and girlfriend, Cheyenne, and I follow them in my rental car for 20 minutes on a paved road before we hit the mud and gravel. We pass several signs with information about where to report crimes. We pass a gravel pit full of gutted pickup trucks and old barrels, where several people stand around a bonfire of pallets drinking. We park in a little pullout. Ryan and Cheyenne grab my gear and lead me along a skinny trail to the canoes, the dogs running ahead. In the middle of the lake, Ryan says, "Caroline," and points to the sky. It's a blazing green ribbon of Aurora Borealis. I have only seen such a display once before in my life, when I lay on the frozen lake at Chickaloon with my brothers in the dead of winter. We reach the houseboat on the far side of the lake, but the door is locked and there is no key. Ryan climbs a pillar to the second story and gets in through the window. We make tea and chat for a while. They have been to San Francisco for a wedding. We talk about our families and good restaurants. At 3 a.m, I am sound asleep in a beautiful queen-sized bed next to a muskox skull, 250 miles south of the Arctic Circle. The lake is shallow and muddy, and the reeds along the shore are indeed reminiscent of Chickaloon, as is the particular acidic smell of the northern soil. The living room fills with light reflected off the water, moving light that I sit and watch for a while in the mornings. It takes me back to the first 3 years of my marriage, which we spent at Little Port Walter, Alaska's oldest field research station on the northern tip of Baranof Island. There, Nick and I were two of the 4 year-round residents. The other two were the maintenance man and his wife. When our first daughter was born in 1997, the year-round population increased to 5. We got our groceries and mail once a week by float plane. The communal space in the house was called the Humpy Lounge. I spent many mornings in the Humpy Lounge while Nick worked on the docks caring for NOAA's field populations of king salmon and steelhead. I watched the light come up off the water and illuminate the ceiling, and on the stormy days, I watched the intense rain and wind pelt the glass. The daylight hours shortened and lengthened. The bay froze and melted. Our solitude was both difficult and exhilarating. Here is where I write the sequence of poems that I sent to the Stanford Creative Writing Program. This work earned me a place at the table with the other poets, none of whom I knew or had even heard of. Truly, the whole experience at Little Port Walter changed my life. So I sit in the living room here in Yellowknife, remembering Alaska. I feel Nick's presence everywhere. I paddle across the lake and drive my rental car into town for groceries. I find a radio station with news in the Gwich'in language. The beautiful sounds rollicking along, interrupted by the words Trump and Tillerson. There are many small hills and ponds, alders and fireweed lining the roads, rocks coming up through the forest, lichens of all colors, pale green, pink, black. There are no mountains, just an enormous expanse of sky with that quality of light so reminiscent of my childhood. Ryan tells me that 237,000 metric tons of arsenic sit stored in containers under the ground here. It's a byproduct of the now defunct Giant Mine, a gold mine that was operational between 1948 and 2004. This is enough arsenic to kill every human being on the planet, which comforts me like a secret. I find the bookstore and buy A History of the Residential Schools, a poetry collection by Rue Borson entitled Cardinal in the Eastern White Cedar, and a book called Brickle, Nish, and Knobbly, A Newfoundland Treasury of Terms for Ice and Snow. The plan for my 10 days here is to focus on finishing the memoir about my daughter Josephine, but these books are just too distracting, and I end up writing a long sequence of poems for Nick, inspired by a line in the Rue Borson poem entitled Mothlight, unreadable book that will not close. Day 3 begins intense winds and a rainstorm that clear the wildfire smoke from the air. I love the sound of the rain on the roof of the houseboat, which reminds me of Littleport. When the storm passes and I wake up at 2 in the morning, the entire sky is alight with aurora borealis. I paddle out and lie down in the canoe, the water like glass holding the reflections. I am surrounded, held. I lie there for an hour. A beaver comes along and slaps its tail a couple of times, and I think I hear a wolf somewhere. Otherwise, the only sound is the patter of tiny waves on the metal hull. I read through field guides and some of Theodore Retke's Straw for the Fire. I work on crocheting a granny square afghan in between writing poems. After 5 nights on the houseboat, I move into a different Airbnb in Old Town for a change of pace. My new friends take me out dancing at the Gold Range, where the Silver Eagle Band is on stage, and Ryan teaches me how to two-step. They take me to my very first strip club, Harley's Hard Rock Saloon, where the beautiful dancer reveals all from the one pole, and then comes down to sit right next to me and ask, in a Russian accent, what brings me to Yellowknife. I tell her about Nick, and she hugs me. Driving home, I get pulled over for going 68 in a 45 zone, and I use the excuse of being American. I forgot about the metric system, I say, and it works. Then it's my second to last day in Yellowknife, and the exact anniversary of Nick's death. 12 months. I can hardly believe it. 12 months ago today, I was riding shotgun in my friend Tony's 1982 Cadillac Seville down Highway 1 in Pacifica, listening to a live version of Ripple by the Grateful Dead. I was waiting anxiously with my phone on my lap, as my daughter had called at 10:30 p.m. to tell me her dad hadn't come home yet from his bike ride. I called the authorities, who said someone would get back to me soon. When it rang and I answered, here's what I heard. Hello, this is Elena Stark from San Mateo County Coroner's Office. I am here with a gentleman who was found at McNee Ranch State Park tonight. Was your husband riding his bike at McNee Ranch State Park tonight? The wheels moving under my feet, Tony gripping the steering wheel and staring straight ahead, my friends reaching out from the back seat to hold my hand, the sounds coming out of my mouth. So again today in Yellowknife, as I have so many times during the past year, I tell myself I get to do whatever the hell I want. Overspend, overeat, oversleep. I roll out of bed at noon and make my coffee. It's a warm, sunny day. I walk along the lakeshore in Old Town, past patches of fireweed and nasturtium, past Pilot's Monument and the dock at Tindy Air, where a twin otter float plane is tied. I remember the plane that took our family back and forth from Sitka to Littleport so many times, that delivered our groceries and mail. How the engine sounded in the sky when it came over the ridge. How one pilot, Mark, always traveled with a black German shepherd named Shadow, who would pace the length of the float as we unloaded supplies. I remember that stare down with the Kushtaka at Lake Temescal in Oakland, California, exactly 10 days before Nick died. Had that really, really happened? There is something strange about the cold light today, the air brushing my cheeks. There are juncos and gold-crowned sparrows in the birches. I keep walking. At the junction of Wiley Road and Pilot's Lane, I arrive at Bullock's Bistro. Time for lunch. Bullock's is a local institution. A tiny log cabin where every square inch of wall and ceiling is covered with bumper stickers, graffiti, boarding passes, business cards, of visitors from every corner of the globe. It smells wonderful. There's only one empty seat at the end of the counter in front of the gas range. I sit down and check out the menu. Fresh fish chowder, reindeer stew or buffalo stew, Nunavut sashimi, my choice of fish, whitefish, lake trout, Arctic char, great slave cod, pickerel, deep-fried, pan-fried, or grilled. My waitress is also the cook, a young woman in a tank top and yoga pants with lots of ink up and down both arms. She smiles at me and calls me love. I order the pan-fried whitefish and a Coke. I look out the window through the bright alders toward the lake and feel both heartbroken and full of wonder. I'm really here. It's really true. The waitress pulls a pan of buns out of the oven and says enthusiastically, "I love bread." Something catches in my throat. I wish I could find another way to say this, but something catches in my throat. This was another inside joke I had with Nick, along with Sasquatch. I am a baker, and I love to fill up my home with the scent of fresh sourdough bread. When Nick would come home from work on my baking days, he'd grab a loaf, tear into it with gusto, and declare with a grin, "Oh, honey, you're the best. I love bread." Whenever we went out to eat and the waiter asked if we'd like bread for the table, Nick would say, "Yes, please," then look at me to announce, "I love bread." I catch the waitress's eye. "Excuse me," I say, "did you just say I love bread?" "Yeah," she says, nodding and tipping the pan of buns into a basket lined with a tea towel. "I love bread." "Can I tell you something?" I ask. "Sure," she says. I stay until the lunch rush dies down. I discover that her name is Allison, also the name of the woman who introduced me to Nick in Sitka in 1990. We talk for a while. She's a young mother. We exchange contact information, become Facebook friends. She gives me a t-shirt and comps my lunch. We hug in the parking lot, and I vow to return with my daughters someday. And back in California, of course my girls love the story. They argue over the black Bullock's Bistro V-neck with Yellowknife NT on the back. They want to wear it every chance they get.
This is Caroline Goodwin, and you just heard my nonfiction story, The Money Place, which is indeed 100% nonfiction. I know some of the events don't seem possible, and believe you me, I wake up every day wondering if the facts of my life are indeed true. Is my husband, my soulmate, really gone? Are my daughters under my roof, and are they safe at this moment? Then I make my coffee, look out into my yard, hear a hummingbird or two, or a robin, or the distant roar of the highway, and I feel blessed simply to be here, to be drawing breath. In the introduction to her poetry collection, Murdered, Missing, San Francisco poet laureate Kim Shuck writes, "Poems are thought cobwebs and rarely change anything. Then again, cobwebs can help stop bleeding. I can't suggest that you enjoy this work, but I hope that you can take strength from it." And then her poem, Day 18. "We sat in my garden and ate nasturtium flowers in November darkness. Glorious heart, I could tell you the stories of the plants, but you knew their names. I want your boy to know how loved you were, the place set aside for you in our home." My story, The Money Place, is like this, something I set aside in my home and heart for my late husband. Thank you for sharing it with me.
You've just heard The Money Place by Caroline Goodwin, read by Kat Miller. The Money Place appears in the fall 2020 issue of Under the Gum Tree, which is available for purchase at underthegumtree.com. You can also subscribe to the magazine and help support one of Northern California's premier literary and visual arts publications. The Stories on Stage Davis podcast will be back on Saturday, November 14th, with a story by Lisa Locascio, whose work has appeared in The Believer, Tin House, N Plus One, Book Forum, and others. She is the author of the new novel, Open Me. We hope you'll tune in. The Stories on Stage Davis podcast is a sponsored project of YOLO Arts, a nonprofit arts organization, and supported in part by a grant from the City of Davis Arts and Cultural Affairs Program. Find upcoming episodes, view our archive of past episodes, and help support our series at storiesonstagedavis.com.